much projection to do it.
What does literature sound like? What stories will we hear if we listen to the archive? Welcome to the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds. My name is Hannah McGregor, and each month I'll be bringing you different stories of Canadian literary history and our contemporary responses to it, created by scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. Relaxing ideas, anxious ideas, loving ideas, and even heated ideas. Feelings aren't just for people. Ideas have feelings too. Or at least that's what our episode contributors this month aim to explore. If ideas do have feelings, how are they communicated? And in turn, how do different ideas, concepts, make us feel? In this episode of the Spoken Web Podcast, graduate students Ali Barilero, Sadie Barker, and Emma Tolaro revisit their experience of making a short-form podcast as an exercise assigned to them by Jason Camlott in his Literature and Sound Studies seminar at Concordia University. The episode explains some of the guiding themes that emerged through discussions that Ali, Sadie, Emma, and Jason had about podcasting as a mode of critical practice, exploring the connections between voice, feeling, and rhetoric. Comprised of recorded Zoom conversations, short audio essays, and featuring three distinct mini-podcasts within a podcast, this episode, the last from year one of the Spoken Web Podcast series, closes the season with a meta-podcast about the practice of podcasting itself. Without further ado, here's the Spoken Web Podcast season finale. Ideas have feelings too. Voice, feeling, and rhetoric in podcasting.
We made a podcast.
Using our podcast voices and other sounds.
And other sounds.
Who are we?
I'm Jason Camlott, a professor in the Department of English and Concordia University Research Chair in Literature and Sound Studies at, well, Concordia University.
I'm Emma Tolaro, a master's student in the Department of English at Concordia University and a research assistant for Spoken Web.
I'm Sadie Barker, a PhD student.
And I'm Ali Barilero, an almost graduated grad student.
Making a collaborative podcast is fun.
But also challenging.
The logistics of who does what and how to bring everything together is one challenge.
But perhaps the greatest challenge has to do with defining the voice that shapes the podcast.
In an audio essay, there is usually a clear narrational perspective.
All the sounds presented are filtered and organized through a single voice, which represents a sonically particular perspective on all that is discussed and heard.
In our case, we have aimed, as much as possible, to allow multiple narrational perspectives to be heard and to shape this podcast episode.
So this podcast, the final episode from year one of the Spoken Web Podcast series, is kind of a meta-podcast about making podcasts. In the winter semester of 2020, I taught a graduate seminar on the topic of literature and sound studies. I'd taught courses on sound and poetry before, but this seminar, more than the ones I'd taught in the past, was committed to bringing interdisciplinary concepts and approaches from sound studies together with literary texts and sound recordings. As my department's annual required theory seminar for PhDs, although it consisted of both PhD students and MA students, it was heavy with critical theories and cultural studies about sound and listening. So we read and discussed together selections from R. Murray Schafer, Friedrich Kittler, and Lisa Gittleman, Jonathan Stern and Myra Mills, Don Ida and Mladen Dolar, Patrick Feaster and Jacob Smith, John Durham Peters and Brandon LaBelle, Douglas Kahn and Dylan Robinson, among many others. We read a few literary works that framed sound, listening, and voice in interesting ways, like Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, Samuel Beckett's Crap's Last Tape. And we considered poets whose work moved between print and sound productions, including the talk poems of David Anton, the erasure poems and time-stretching sound collages of Jordan Abel, and the poetry scripts and audiovisual live performances of Juana Avicilokai. The subject is occurrence.
subject is the eye that brings the sky.
In the context of a literature course that aims to think about sound, it's difficult to do so without having one eye on the print world. It's difficult to think about sound outside of the generic categories we use to think about printed texts. Podcasting about literary sound is kind of an interestingly messy place to be. Already, asking literature students to engage with sound rather than print works to trouble their relationship to their primary source text. Asking them to think through and present their ideas in a sound-based medium was a further exercise in estrangement. They would be required to learn a whole new media rhetoric, one that involved sound editing, speaking and recording their ideas in a voice that seemed right to the purpose, possibly the use of music or ambient sounds to reinforce or frame the ideas and arguments they were making, not to mention arranging, balancing, EQing, mixing, and exporting the final product. The results were awesome in so many ways. Students made podcasts about noise.
Ah, the hustle and bustle of the city.
And silence.
Silence, then, is not really the absence of sound, but the beginning of listening. And when there is nothing to hear, you start to hear things.
And why most audiobooks aren't satisfying.
I generally dislike audiobooks. And I wouldn't listen to a recorded book if I could just read the book instead.
And why Samuel Beckett's radio plays are awesome.
Now, to be somewhat self-reflexive, Beckett's story is partially about the very need to find a voice.
And how Sylvia Plath's confessional poetry is as extra as Lana Del Rey.
In this podcast, I'll speak about the rhetorical strategy of exaggeration in relation to the confessional mode, using the work of Sylvia Plath and Lana Del Rey.
And how the running voice in your head talking to itself is kind of like a never-ending hip-hop track.
Some words just make me feel uncomfortable. Like soot. Ugh. That fire debris thing or whatever. You can't see, but I just shivered saying that. They should really make some kind of visual podcast. Like a vodcast. No?
At the same time that everyone was working on their own podcasts, I was also at work on one with my colleague Catherine McLeod that eventually got released as episode 8 of this podcast series, the episode entitled, How Are We Listening Now? Signal, Noise, Silence. And I'd already worked on my very first podcast in the fall, episode 2, called Sound Recordings Are Weird. It hadn't occurred to me how difficult choosing and performing a voice in a podcast would be until I tried making a podcast myself.
Alfred Tennyson. Alfred Lord Tennyson. Lord Alfred Tennyson.
The complexity of voice as a performative and expressive factor in the context of a podcast is about authority, expertise, positionality, all of which Ali, Sadie, Emma, and I discuss later in this podcast. But it's also about something else, something that, for me at least, is coming to define what a podcast does to ideas, concepts, and arguments. It has to do with affect and feeling, the proximity of the speaker to her ideas, the proximity of the listener to the speaker sharing an idea, the affective exchange that is inseparable from the conceptual exchange when a podcaster talks about something. Stacey Copeland explains this idea powerfully in a recent article when she observes that
there is an inherent intimacy in voice-driven sound work that seems to be soaking in affect. The listener puts on her headphones, presses play, and becomes immersed in an affective discourse of human experience through listening and connecting.
So one way in which ideas have feelings is through their expression and effective communication in voice. Another way that we came to realize how ideas have feelings during the process of making our podcasts is through the broader sonic affordances of the medium, especially the way we come to obsess with the use of music and ambient sounds in presenting stories and ideas. Podcasting uses sound to help us experience how a concept feels. So that covers voice and feeling as we'll be discussing those topics in this podcast. When we say the rhetoric of podcasting, we're thinking of everything that Aristotle included in his definition of the concept of rhetoric as a means of persuasion, which encompassed A, the character of the speaker, B, the emotional state of the listener, and C, the argument, logos, itself. The first two elements of rhetoric as a method are pretty well covered by our categories of voice and feeling. I would define the last element, that of argument or logos, as including the first two, plus the overarching structure, genre, that we choose to use in arranging and shaping our podcast, and also the degree to which this form of communication engages in explicit kinds of reflection upon its own rhetorical affordances and strategies. We may come to feel ideas as tenets of authentic truth, but this is so because the modes of rhetorical persuasion we use have become normalized to a point that we just don't notice them or think about them anymore. An ideology of rhetoric sets in. And a sense of the end of rhetoric, as John Bender and David Welbury have dubbed it, is felt. Sometimes rhetorical protocols can come to seem so useful, normal, so right to community that uses it, that the rhetoric of it seems to disappear altogether. It's through the migration of rhetorical protocols across communities that we can find rhetoric work, interestingly, at cross purposes with its original community. Like when biblical discourse or legal discourse is repurposed by communities of poets, novelists, cartoonists, comedians. It is due to this perpetual migration of rhetorical forms, media, and effects across communities that I think podcasting represents such a powerful tool for scholarly communication and humanities pedagogy at the present time. Podcasting, in practice, is a great way to make us see and feel the rhetorical and media assumptions we use to produce and share knowledge in our respective scholarly disciplines. A new kind of awareness of the rhetoric of thought has been another outcome of the experience of engaging in podcasting as a form of critical expression, and this is an experience that we all seem to share. So, with these keywords, voice, feeling, rhetoric, briefly explained, and with the basic plan mapped out, first, here is Ali Barilaro presenting her podcast on the meaning of applause in poetry readings.
When I started working with Spoken Web, I didn't really know what I wanted to research, so Jason told me to start by listening through the Sir George Williams poetry series and to take notes on anything that caught my attention. That ended up being the sounds of applause and the frequently conflicted comments different poets made about the presence of applause in poetry readings. So I spent my first year as an RA trying to come up with better ways of talking about applause because just measuring duration and amplitude didn't seem good enough to me. If I wanted to find the why, if that's really possible, I needed to look at the wider context. I had already produced a 5-minute talk, a 1-hour workshop, and a 12-page paper on this topic. On the page, I had to describe the sounds of applause and use screenshots of waveforms and spectrograms. None of that really does the sound justice. With the podcast, it was a lot easier to weave narration or argument and the source material in and out of one another, which I think makes for a more immersive listening experience.
Thank you. It sounds peculiar when it's said that way, though.
Applause. A sign of approval, an act of support, a cultural indicator worth listening to. In John Bulwer's Manual of Rhetorical Gestures, Chirologia, he explains that to clap the raised hands one against another is an expression proper to them who applaud, congratulate, rejoice, assent, approve, and are well pleased, used by all nations. This public token hath been of old, and is so usual in the assembly of a multitude, when they cannot contain their joy in silence. Bulwer's contemplation of applause, however, quickly takes on a judging tone, with concerns about decorum and the appropriateness of the gesture in particular artistic contexts. Addressing the inherent duality of applause, Stephen Connor posits that clapping one hand on another dramatizes the fact that you are subject and an object simultaneously, a doer and a done to. Applause, it seems, belongs to both the individual and the crowd. It can be deliberate or uncontained, disregarded or powerful. In the context of the archival sounds of recorded poetry readings collected by Spoken Web, we can hear not only poetic voice or textual content, we hear the sounds of interactivity and reception, we hear traces of the relationships between speaker and audience that ground the poetry reading as public, as event. Despite their potential significance, sonic manifestations of audience response, including laughter and verbal address, are not consistently present or consistently treated by poets, series organizers, recordists, and archivists. In 1966, acclaimed Montreal poet Louis Dudek was invited to introduce Henri Bissell and Mike Naroski's reading as part of the poetry series at Sir George Williams University. Dudek attempts to set the tone and establish the appropriate reading series etiquette as he reflects on his effective response to Bissell's performance, stating,
"Strongly I was impressed and moved by that reading of Henri Bissell."
From a position as both audience member and poet, he explains,
"Really, several times after the poems I wanted to applaud, only we don't do that."
If applause isn't universally accepted as a fundamental part of the poetry reading, why are there so many instances of applause heard throughout the Sir George Williams collection? Despite concerns of impropriety, applause can function as a demonstration of etiquette or a measurement and influencer of public feeling, as Sarah Balkin claims. Tanya Clement and Stephen McLaughlin frame applause as both enabling an audience's ability to engage in dialogue with a poem itself and affect its mode of meaning-making, or as a signifier of structures marking the transitions between different elements of a reading. Most examples of applause can be labeled either procedural, referring to moments thought to be appropriate or expected in a reading series, or as purely spontaneous phenomena. Though spontaneous applause appears to be more appreciative in nature, procedural applause is not exclusively formal or inherently removed from appreciation for the poet, the work, or the performance. Another key feature of applause is the concept of consensus, which implies a communal response from the majority or all of the audience to a given performance. A noticeable lack of consensus is often perceived as uncomfortable. Caused by what Tia Denora describes as individuals or small groups of people lacking the skill and practical knowledge necessary for appropriate emotional responses in a given performative context. Moments in the Sir George Williams recordings can be used as case studies to examine consensus, procedural, and spontaneous applause, and to begin to unpack what specific sounds of audience response might signify when listened to within the greater context of an entire reading and the series as a whole. Let's listen to the response to Irving Layton's Confederation Ode, read at Sir George Williams University in 1967 as an example. Layton was certainly no stranger to praise. His final poem of the night, Family Portrait, receives the longest and loudest unedited record of applause found in the Poetry Series collection. A 40-second auditory event so intense, we could call it a wall of noise. Layton's opening remarks draw attention to the makeup of the sizable crowd gathered to hear him.
"I'm very glad to see so many of my friends and former students in the audience."
A statement elaborated upon in a postgrad article that details the overcrowding of the venue that hosted the university's then poet in residence. Consensus, then, is not at issue for Layton. What is worth questioning is the spontaneity of the reaction to a poem like Confederation Ode that was new at the time of the reading, especially considering Layton classics like Misunderstanding and The Birth of Tragedy are met with no audible response. Beyond finding out who is in the audience, the location and timing of the reading is also crucial to the discussion. With Expo 67 scheduled to begin just over a month after this Montreal performance, and with the poem's bold sexual imagery and overt political satire, Layton correctly assumes he need not explain his intent further than a simple preface.
"My contribution to the centennial year, Confederation Ode."
For the audience to receive his message and respond accordingly. The question still remains open, though. Why did this audience react so strongly to this Layton poem in that moment? The ephemerality of the event and lack of corresponding oral history work makes it hard to firmly pin down an answer, but further inroads can be made with the use of growing audio archives that could potentially allow scholars to trace a poet's reading history, cross-referencing multiple performances of a given piece and documenting the range of responses from audiences over time and across space. For the Confederation Ode applause, further research into Leighton's biography and public sentiment about Expo 67 and the Canadian government more broadly may also elucidate some of the meaningful resonances the performance affected in Leighton's listeners. Thank you. When Jason, Emma, Sadie, and I got together for a series of Zoom meetings to replay and talk about our podcasts a few months after making them, hearing the episodes quickly conjured up a few feelings.
I said something to Emma and Sadie about how I realized I kind of sound like some weird robot presenter lady in my podcast, and it's so cringy to listen to. Because that's not how I talk normally at all.
It's always embarrassing to hear your own voice back, right? You know, to some extent, especially when you hear like, I'm trying to do my podcast voice, right? You know,
I think I'm trying to sound like an informational guide. I think there was only one or two very brief moments in my mini podcast that I was trying to break away from that. I remember in one of your comments that one of the parts that you were like, yes, that's what you should be going for more, was just me going, at something. You were like, yeah, like that's something we would want to hear.
Yeah, it's because that was so Allie, right? You know, and so it's like...
Overall, I think the end result was relatively well produced, and that I managed to convey a general sense of the work I've done on Applause within such a limited time frame. But the thing that we all kept coming back to was my voice. What exactly was going on there?
What does that mean, first of all, to be doing a podcast voice? What is it?
It's funny because I remember when I was in Seja, I had an assignment where my friends and I made a video about composting, and I decided to narrate it, and it sounded exactly like that. So it's been like a thing for like a long time, and I don't know why, why that's my go-to voice. I don't know. It's weird. It's very weird.
Could you do that voice right now, like on command?
Let me pull up something that I could like read, because I can't do it just like speaking spontaneously, because that's not how I talk. Okay, let's see. The contents field serves to describe the audible content, speech, and other sounds of the audio asset.
It seems so kind of genre dependent. Like your podcast, the content wise was quite academic, and it was funny because like listening to it, I actually didn't notice a difference in voice at all, but then just now when you performed your voice, I really noticed it. So there's something about like the setting of the content setting that where you kind of assume a certain voice, and because it really stood out in this very more casual settings.
I think it's hard not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as soon as you have a device in front of you, like tense up, and that's I think more often than not what happens.
I guess it's like it also feels like a safer way of doing it. Like it feels less vulnerable to have that kind of voice and not just have people listen to what you actually sound like.
So you're performing the voice of sort of pure information, would you say?
I want it to be straightforward. I want it to be clear. Yeah, I want people to understand what I'm trying to say to them. And I, for some reason, in my head, that's what that sounds like.
Would you say that you're trying to make your voice almost disappear in the communication of the information so that it's like it's there, but hopefully won't be noticed?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to do. Because for some reason, I guess like my own natural voice doesn't seem like the best, the best possible option for doing that. And it's often when it's something that's scripted and it's not like, it's not theater or something like that. It's something that is like argumentative or analytical or theoretical. That's what that voice sounds like in my head. So I'm trying to perform that rather than something that's more conversational or more natural or more performative in a different way.
Everyone had a lot to say about their own decisions regarding the performance of the role of podcast host or narrator, and I'll be back later in the episode to lead you through some of our major realizations about voice.
Emma Talaro.
The podcast I created for Jason's class, I named Conditionally Audible Heat, though future iterations should have a punchier name. Broadly speaking, my podcast examines the sonification of heat in the archival recording of the 1974 Margaret Atwood reading from the Sir George Williams University's reading series. The curiosity I felt for this particular tape begins in listening. On the occasion of this performance, the reading is upstaged by an unbearable and unlikely October heat. The introducers, Atwood, stumble over the heat, the crowd shuffles restlessly, and this frenzy, infectious, makes its way through the audio recording. I found this occurrence mesmerizing and, in a fit of note-taking, attempted to mark all the moments when heat, though constant, materialized and usurped the reading. And yet, there wasn't a specific quality or sound associated with this heat, but a convergence, rather. So I wondered, what in the first place was I listening to? What does heat sound like? How does it manifest in audio recording, and what sensations does it provoke? I listened and listened again. So, I inched towards my driving question, how do we hear heat? I felt that to answer this question, what does heat sound like, to attempt a podcast on the sonification of heat, I had to begin with the event itself. Heat announces itself from the very beginning of the reading.
Can you ask the security people to turn on the cooling system? The hall is going to be too hot.
And I wanted to give a sense of the temporality of the event, the time elapsed and distorted by heat as it presses languorously and anxiously onto the reading. I had to find a way to do this, to describe, engage with, and represent 35 minutes of audio in a 6-minute podcast. The podcast really took off with the introductory audio collage. Once I decided that my primary task was to sound heat, I clipped elements from the beginning of the recording to create the collage and timed it to fit a sultry musical track I found online. It felt very much like I was assembling quotations. I treated the clips, whether of speech or exterior sound, as fragments and pieced them together. To get the sounds to hit at the right time was a minute task, and the more I edged towards the effects I wanted, the more finicky I got. That first sound, the one moment you'll hear, took ages to place on the right beat. And, significantly, I selected it because it's the first voice you hear in the archival recording. I felt strongly about keeping it. That short phrase captures the mood of the reading, the disorder, the tension in the sound and feel of the room. You'll notice how the speaker, Henry Bicell, signals the overflow, the bodies massed in the room, and you'll hear the humor too, which recurs in the event as necessary relief.
One moment. We did try to get a larger hall, but it was impossible. To accommodate the overflow, we have set up loudspeakers in the little gallery here. Howard, and in the other one too?
Outside,
they're loudspeakers. So please don't all crowd into the room. Can you ask the security people to turn on the cooling system? The hall is going to be too hot.
I mean, I don't see any reason why this thing should resemble a steam bath. If everybody on the chairs would shift over this way and sit on sort of as if it were a bench, then some more people could sit on the edges there. It's fucking hot.
Montreal, October 18th, 1974. It's hot. Really hot. An unlikely hot autumn evening. Margaret Atwood is set to perform at the Poetry Series, a reading series organized by the Sir George Williams University's English Department, now Concordia University. The room is jammed. She begins to read.
Is not one. Oh boy, is it ever hot in here. I can't stand it. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Atwood's performance is of peculiar interest for two reasons. First, she's one of the few women invited to read at the series. Second, the reading is overwhelmed by this autumn heat wave. In the recording of this performance, we hear Atwood repeatedly reference this oppressive heat, and we hear the audience members too, shuffling and speaking excitedly as they crowd into the room. We hear this especially in the first few minutes of the recording and in the Q&A that follows her performance. The reading itself is cut short to accommodate the unusual weather, which is ironic, perhaps, given our first point.
I think I better read just three more poems before we all die.
In an article written for The Guardian called Boiling Point, Why Literature Loves a Long, Hot Summer, Ida Edemariam writes, novelists have used heat waves to create tension, erotic charge, and moments of possibility. It is a time when all the rules change. Of course, we're not speaking of a fictional heat wave, but of a real, historical, and material manifestation of heat. And yet, we might pursue a literary analysis and say that the sweaty, hot room acts as a framing device for the poetry reading. Or, if we want to borrow a term from sound studies, we might include heat in a study of the reading soundscape. But how, in the first place, does heat sound forth? How do we hear heat? What is the significance of an audible heat? For the most part, we're listening to the effects of heat. Heat acts on bodies, bodies contribute to heat, voice and movement manifest discomfort or pleasure in discomfort. The audible manifestations of heat, Atwood's humorous quips, her nervous laugh, the frenzied audience response, highlight the sociality of performance. Heat dramatizes the encounter between audience and performer. And despite the very real, constrained material circumstances of the reading, heat provides a release from constraints. We sense the overflow in the room, which contributes to this sense of possibility that emerges out of close contact with Atwood and her poems. Later, she jokes about being called a witch by some critics, which adds fuel to her feminism and speaks to the disarming power of her poetics. In this heat, with Atwood, we anticipate something. Boundaries might be crossed.
How are you doing? Is it hot and steamy? Has anybody died yet?
Heat helps us imagine what it might have felt like to be there. And it is remarkable that we can retrieve the sensation, if only ever immediately, through recording. Heat is a conjuring trick. It signals presence even in absence. We hear the spatio-temporal and material circumstances of Atwood's reading. We hear the body, and of course, we hear the poems. And it all feels quite sweaty. We've talked about the sociality of performance sounded through heat, but there's also the various meanings that shift in reading. Heat alters the poems themselves. Where and how you listen matters to how you receive meaning in the poem. Imagine a late summer evening, or if you prefer, a blazing mid-August sun entering deep, deep into the pores of your skin. Can you taste the sweat, smell the humidity? Or is it a dry heat, red and sandy? Are you close to, far from other bodies? How does the clothes feel on your skin? What sounds are there around you?
Late August. This is the plum season, the nights blue and distended, the moon hazed. This is the season of peaches with their lush lobed bulbs that glow in the dusk, apples that drop and rot sweetly, their brown skins veined as glands. No more the shrill voices that cried, need, need, from the cold pond, bladed and urgent as new grass. Now it is the crickets that say, ripe, ripe, slurred in the darkness, while the plums dripping on the lawn outside our window burst with a sound like thick syrup, muffled and slow. The air is still warm, flesh moves over flesh, there is no hurry.
Late August felt like the most fitting and only close, a return to the poem that felt nostalgic and dreamlike. Throughout the podcast, I focused mostly on extra poetic speech, but the quality of her voice in reading shifts tellingly too. The anxious, frenetic pace indicating unbearable heat slows when she reads. Late August is this languor, this culmination, this release, the beautiful yet dark aura of the plums, ripe, the seductive quality of late August heat that focuses heat as an affective and aesthetic experience. It's a heat which makes its way through autumn cracks, the kind of heat that sometimes surprises us here in Montreal. It's the heat of the poetry reading from the bodies in the room, giving grain to the voice, to the poem. I wanted to end here in late August to return to the poem, to listening, to feeling. If I speak late August, I think of the swarming of bees by the Lachine Canal, but also the humidity that hangs on, that persists despite the signs of fall. There are sounds to these feelings, to describing these images. It's perhaps a matter of listening more closely, of finding the right vocabulary for them.
Sadie Barker.
For the last 4 years, I've tree planted in northern BC. I would do this between my schooling, where especially more recently, I've been thinking and learning about sound studies. And these interests came together last summer when I brought a recorder with me to camp with the intention of recording the day-to-day world of tree planting. So when I wasn't planting trees, I was walking around camp, interviewing people.
Okay, Michelle. We're recording.
Collecting the sounds of camp life and just amassing various audio. So I was pretty excited when in Jason's class I had the opportunity to assemble it. Because I already had several hours of tape, I was in many ways advantaged going into this assignment. But I was still apprehensive. I'd never made a podcast before. While I'd written lots of essays and could appreciate music and sound, I'd never attempted to tell any kind of audio story. As someone that studies multimedia and aesthetics, podcasting made me realize that while I research and write on these topics, I hadn't really ever diversified or experimented with my own modes of expression. I hadn't ever really tried to facilitate an aesthetic experience itself beyond formal academic writing. So this assignment made me reflect on the tendencies, comforts, and familiarities of my own academic modes. It's 5:45 a.m., cold, and the clothes you pull on to your shivering body in the pitch black of your tent are damp, coated in dew and sweat from the day before. Outside, the sun has not yet risen, but the gravel pit bears its first signs of life nonetheless. The hum of the generator and the few early risers sitting on the breakfast trailer steps, brushing their teeth, smoking cigarettes, chewing the fat. This is the stretch of calm before the day. In 15 minutes, the breakfast trailer doors will open and people will shuffle through, heaping scrambled eggs and oatmeal onto silver trays to eat in the tent, both anticipating the day to come and cherishing these moments of idleness. At 7 a.m., everyone will board their trucks and leave for the cut block to spend the next 10 hours planting trees. I could try and describe these 10 hours and the world of possibility they hold, but Charlotte Gill's book, Eating Dirt, does it much better.
Planting trees isn't hard. As any veteran will tell you, it isn't the act of sowing itself, but the ambient complications. It comes with snow pellets or clouds of biting insects so thick and furious it's possible to end a day with your eyelids swollen shut and blood trickling from your ears. There are swaying fields of venomous plants like devil's club and stinging nettle. The work has the bodily effect of a car crash in extreme slow motion. Besides that, the task itself is thankless and boring, which is to say, it's plain and silent. What could compel a person to make a career of such a thing? I have always wanted to find out.
I'm Marcus Benke. I'm from Terrace, British Columbia. And
my name is Belle.
Second year tree planter.
And I'm from Vancouver.
My name is Liam Hanna.
Oh, my name is Alana.
I'm from Toronto.
I've been planting for 7 years.
And I've been planting for 4 years.
Hey, I'm Blue.
Four years.
I'm from Thailand. Yeah. I've been planting. This is my third season.
2 years.
My name is Kara.
I've done Quebec.
I am from Thornbury, Ontario.
My name is Sebastian.
I am
from
a couple weeks
Northern
now,
BC.
First year.
I've been planting for, this is my second full season planting.
There are many different kinds of planters. People come from all sorts of places and plant for all kinds of reasons. But most planters will tell you that the happiest part of any season is May, before any of the real work has started.
So if they say there are three parts to the planting season.
This is Liam.
And they map onto each month. There's May, the honeymoon month, where everybody's having a good time, and they're enjoying themselves. They just got here. They're partying a lot every night. It's really fun.
You spend so much time with these people, so...
This is Kim.
Yeah, it feels... Leaving and coming back, it feels like camp as a little kid, like seeing all these people that you've connected with.
I think there's like a creative energy.
This is Belle.
Music and art, I feel like that is sort of always happening in the background of camp.
People are just pretty cheerful. It's everybody's like quite happy, ready to get to know each other and
Wonderwall.
Joke around. And
when you're around the fire and everyone's laughing and someone's playing guitar, and then again you just sit back and you just go, wow, this is good.
Katie, it's not Katie's all request hour.
Hey, do you know Katie?
Jeez, come on.
And then June hits.
It's the June blues.
And people are getting exhausted and they go downhill.
This is when reality starts to set in. When the bodily effect of a car crash in slow motion that Charlotte Gill was referencing starts to occur.
It's really hard to justify like the toll it's taken on my body because I felt so...
This is Michelle.
Physically able before coming.
Mm-hmm. I have a huge gash in like the webbing between my thumb and my index finger.
My feet are the regularly cramping.
Common tendonitis.
It's like a Charlie horse in my foot. I don't know what I've done to my back.
Foot pain.
So some ribs 2 days ago, I woke up and I could barely
my knee started swelling up.
Right eye.
And I took my first day off ever.
From a black fly. Wow.
And so I hobble around and struggle to get in and out of the truck and struggle to get in and out of bed. And
so what do you think? Is it worth it?
I don't know. I don't know.
This is also when the days start to feel long.
The time doesn't fly enough.
Really long.
Well, the worst thing that I find in tree planting is definitely the loneliness.
It doesn't seem like no birds are singing or nothing. Everything is just gray and...
If you have one bad thought on the block, then it can just stick with you all day long.
And it's always been the hardest job I've ever done. And probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
But, like today...
And then...
At some point, I sat on the log.
July hits.
And I just started laughing.
And it's the homecoming stretch.
And I was laughing by myself for like a big 2 minutes. And then I just stood up again and planted.
And what do you think? Will you be coming back again?
Yeah, see, that's a hilarious question.
People always say it's the last season, then they come back.
Obviously, I'm saying never again after this season. That's the struggle now, where it's like, yeah, I'll come back. No, I won't. Yeah, I will. No, I won't. Back and forth, back and forth. I think...
Well, I think this is my last year. I think this is my last year, but I said that last year, so who knows? Everybody always says that.
I said that, I think it was my third year, that I would never come back, and now I'm at 4 years later, so I guess it does something right.
It's funny hearing your own voice and podcast, maybe especially when it's your first. I remember at the time of making this, not really having a plan. Maybe because this combination of sound and text was a new medium for me, not having a deliberate sense of process. But maybe because of that, having a sense of freedom. I knew I wanted to capture the everydayness of planting, and I was excited by the possibility that I didn't need to directly argue for the everyday or pose it as a structured thesis necessarily, but that I could present it experientially to the listener. I remember gravitating to certain sounds almost impulsively and assembling them in ways that just felt intuitive. It's interesting now to hear the sounds that came through and the ways in which they did. The sound of the generator, for me, is interchangeable with the sound of the alarm clock. Both mean early morning. They mean that the cook is likely starting to make breakfast and you should probably be mobilizing out of your tent. This parallel, I think, was the underlying rationale for putting those sounds in almost overlapped proximity. The sounds of the beer can and the fire and the instruments and banter, those sounds for me capture the social world of planting. And the sound of the rain on the tent in the morning, which is always the first thing you hear and notice because it cues exactly the kind of planting day it will be, seem to perfectly sound the ways in which planting is almost always at the mercy of the environment. So I wanted to forefront those visceral relations between planters and their everyday surroundings, and I think podcasting allowed me to do that in ways that were more in accord and representative of planting as itself an immersive and sensory and experiential medium.
As Sadie, Emma, and I talked about our podcast together with Jason, we found ourselves coming back to three key themes, including what we're calling feeling or ambiance and rhetoric. But we probably had the most to say about voice, about vocal performance, intent, effects, and affect.
Listening to your natural voice recorded is also kind of scary.
Halle Barilaro.
Having that option to sound like somebody else, I guess, in a way, is like a safety blanket, sort of.
That's a really interesting point. I think it's a great point. I'm not surprised, but I find it interesting that clarity and authority means voice evacuated of emotional characteristics or traits, right? You know, mm-hmm. Which is also protective because it shows that you're not vulnerable to emotion, right? So in this version of podcast voice, we're inclined to evacuate our voices of emotion to communicate authority, clarity, and to somehow twist our personalities into some kind of robotic version of ourselves, you know, maybe avatars against, you know, that more authoritative robotic version of self-performance, but actually is about putting yourself out there and being casual and being yourself.
A lot of that comes from also feeling like sort of inadequately prepared to be that authoritative speaker as a student. And for an assignment for a class, the audience was all of us technically, like the other students, but it's also Jason. So it's a little hard to step back from that, even though you're aware that you can, and we were encouraged to do so in the podcast form. It's very hard to stop doing that.
Emma, did you feel you were also engaging in a kind of a different version of yourself, a more transparent or somehow, you know, objective version of yourself in your vocal performance in your podcast? Or were you doing a different kind of voice?
I think on some level I was.
Emma Talaro.
Just because this was a podcast that was assigned to us within an academic setting. So, and I was talking about heat in my podcast, and I realized how that could become quickly humorous. I think like you, Ali, I kind of feel like, oh, that was a little bit of a missed opportunity. I could have made a bunch of like really silly jokes about heat. But also I was sometimes actively trying to avoid that because I was afraid that that wouldn't make it not serious. I often do think about that idea of the authoritative voice and how as a student, it's difficult to ever feel like you have one. And also like as a woman, having like a high-pitched voice is not necessarily normally seen as authoritative. So it's something I often think about on the daily, especially at school, because I also find that my voice at the university is not the voice I have when I'm at home with my parents or when I'm at a bar with my friends. It fluctuates so much, and it's something I pay a lot of attention to. And I think for this podcast, I wanted to find like a medium, like how can I be myself, but also sound like better than I am, which is maybe like a silly, insecure thought, but it's a thought that I'm sure everyone has as soon as they're being recorded.
I think a lot of us are kind of self-conscious about sounding not too shrill, not too loud, and like not too high-pitched. I think my voice is actually quite deep. Like even now I'm realizing listening to myself that when I'm talking and I know I'm being recorded, I do often try to keep it to the lower registers of my voice.
I used to sing, so it brought me back to being like in a recording studio, and it brought me back to that moment, like right before you record, like that sort of the acknowledgement you have in your head of like, okay, well now I'm putting on this performative voice. And that voice felt a little bit similar to my singing voice because I was trying to like, I think, extend the words and circle around the letters in a way that I don't when I'm speaking casually. So it's also a fake casual voice, I think.
Yeah, a performed casual voice, which is a big part of the podcasting voice that we often hear. When's it acceptable to have emotion, like for a narrator to have emotion, or host to have emotion in a podcast? Because I definitely don't either in my narrations, at least the ones I've done so far. It's been pretty much based on like my grade 8 radio assignment, you know, voice. I don't think I've regressed very much in thinking about how I'm supposed to sort of project or what a narrator is really supposed to be. I think I'm trying to be clear. So I totally get what Ali was saying earlier about wanting to enunciate well, at the same time to sound casual or conversational so that the text I'm reading doesn't sound like it's being read. There's this kind of attempt to strike a really impossible or unnatural thing, balance between reading text, so sounding like an actual text that's being read, but being a voice that's doing that text in a manner that sounds conversational. I think there's a lot of that kind of communicating a sense of reception through how one speaks back to what someone said without always saying, yes, I understand. Yes, I like what you're saying. It's coming across through these vocal modes of expression instead, in timbre and in register, in the voice itself. Earlier in this conversation, like Ali, when you're laughing, you know, about yourself and everything like that, that's all there. And it's like, oh, that sounds like a podcast voice to me, like much more than the formal narrator's voice that we all seem to sort of slot ourselves into.
Sadie Barker.
It's true that podcasters, like I'm thinking of even someone like Ira Glass, kind of walks this line between being kind of well-spoken, but also can kind of respond naturally and with emotion on the spot, and how it's a really fine balance.
If you were to perform a different podcasting voice, to sort of give us an example of what your voice might sound like if you were to redo your podcast, having reflected a little bit on, you know, the voice that you did use, what would that sound like?
Wake up, everyone. It's 5:45. No. I think maybe I would just try to adopt the shifts in energy more. Like, I think the podcast starts with kind of a lower energy, but it does kind of rise. I would reflect maybe more on my own experiences, my own personal reflections, take less of a back position and come to the fore more.
What about you, Emma? Would your voice change, do you think?
I'm thinking about it now. It was a very literary voice, I think, I was trying to mimic. And I think I was also trying to match it with Atwood's, knowing that I would be putting the clips together. Whereas, like, if I were talking about pizza, which I'm also super passionate about, it would be a very different voice. And I'm also thinking, like, Sadie, I wouldn't want you to lose that, like, rising quiet quality, because it's as much part of the story as is the other speakers or the content. It is like a question of matching tone or timbre to content in the same way that we do when we're writing. It shifts, but there is always something there that speaks of the author, right? Whatever that is. I don't know. I don't know if that answers the question. I guess it wouldn't change. It would maybe change. I don't know. Depends what I'd be focusing on this time.
If I had to respond to this question, I'd say it might sound something like this.
Sir George's then poet in residence, Irving Layton, was no stranger to praise. His final poem of the night received the longest and loudest unedited record of applause found in the entire poetry series collection. A 40-second auditory event so intense, I call it a wall of noise. In his opening remarks, Leighton proudly draws attention to the sizable crowd in front of him.
I'm very glad to see so many of my
Emma Tolaro.
It seemed that the medium we were dabbling in, podcasting, demanded that we concentrate feeling, that it was part of the argument, content, and narrative voice of our podcasting selves. The relational, immersive, and affective experience of sound and of podcasting guided our thematic discussion on feeling. Jason asked us to recall moments from our podcast that were soaking in affect and to reflect on the achievements and challenges of these. We all thought of Sadie's very successful rendering of the ambiance of camp and in particular of her campfire clip.
I sampled the sounds of people jamming and then I sampled sounds of people conversing. I think it was really an attempt to describe the sort of social atmosphere of planting that really, it seemed much more informative to use these small sounds as opposed to saying, you know, usually there's 12 people standing around a fire and there'll be some people playing instruments. And I don't know, it just, yeah, made me kind of reflect on how the smallest sound can be so telling and so much more telling than kind of a lengthy description. I chose the scene because I thought it really captured the ambiance of camp.
Sadie aptly negotiates images through sound so that we feel like we're there, sitting around the campfire. If Sadie sought to sample the atmosphere of camp, I focused on the ambiance of a room. My podcast, in a sense, was about feeling, the feeling of heat at the poetry reading event.
How are you doing? Is it hot and steamy?
The goal was to transmit a listening experience that centered heat, to listen closely to the room, and from there, ease into a discussion of the reading event that preserved its heated texture. The heat felt all-consuming, shares much with Sadie's rain, calling forth sensations, images, and memories that are otherwise inaccessible. I've never been planting in northern BC, but I can hear the rain on my tent, regardless. Just like I had not been present, nor alive, during the Atwood reading, and yet I feel and know that heat from that October night. While Sadie and I focused on the feel of our particular subject matter, the sound of camp and of heat, of tree planting, and of the poetry reading, Allie asks, what does podcasting itself sound like? Allie quite brilliantly questions the mood evoked by the genre and sets a tone for the experience of listening to an informational form of communication. What remains consistent across our podcasts and in our discussion of feeling is this focus on our affective relationship to sound. The affordances of the medium seem vast in this regard. How to translate feeling, affect, how to tell, what rhetorical methods might be used.
Sadie Barker.
Our approach with this podcast was to structure it around thematic discussions, voice and ambiance being two. But now we land at structure itself. How do we bring all of these components together to make one coherent but also hopefully compelling narrative? Just like the structuring of this very podcast, determined through brainstorming, Zooming, and certainly some trial and error, our approaches to structure were varied.
It was the same feeling of having to fill up a blank page and like, where do you start? Where do you end?
I wanted to start with a statement.
I knew I wanted to have the emotional arcs be the primary structure.
Like the whole thing to me felt like a collage.
I found it very difficult. Found it very hard. I just had a lot to say.
But before we get into any of that, Jason usefully summarizes what exactly we're talking about when we say structure and rhetoric.
So when I talk about rhetoric, I'm thinking of the handling of different registers so that you create a kind of persistently interesting series of sounds that keeps the listener engaged from start to finish, combined with a kind of understanding of a beginning, middle, and end.
And as leader of the discussions, he offers some useful sound bites towards structuring this very segment.
But maybe we can each reflect a little bit on the challenges of the overall structure and arrangement of our podcast.
In doing this reflecting, I started to realize that these categories of voice, ambiance, and now rhetoric and structure, ones that we'd been discussing somewhat separately, were connected, entirely connected. Feeling and ambiance suddenly seemed integral to how my podcast was constructed.
In my case, I knew I wanted to have the emotional arcs of the season be the primary structure, but that was structurally quite ambiguous. And so I had Liam, who is my partner and a planter, describe those emotional arcs in the language that everyone recognizes as the honeymoon and the burnout and the home stretch, just to provide a bit of structure to the listener that cues the transition.
But I also realized that voice and its spectrum of intonation and register was key to the structural shifts themselves.
I did really rely on the voices of planters to capture the different emotional registers of those moments. There was an interview with this girl, Zoe, and she was describing a really miserable day on the block. And then she kind of goes, but then I just pick myself up and I start planting, and being really drawn to that but, because it just captured both in what she was saying, but the intonation, like this shift in register that really mobilized the next chapter. So it was interesting to think about the content of what people were saying, but then also just how the sound and the way she said that one word cued that we were in a different emotional space.
Cool. Yeah, it's amazing how just a single intonational shift can actually signal, okay, new part. And it shows how much feeling is a determining factor in the segment or shaping of argument in podcasting.
And just like with structuring an essay, where everyone seems to take a different approach to argument, some brainstorm, others start with the thesis, and others just begin with no particular sense of how, my approach in many ways seemed to differ from Ali's, which was to
start with a statement rather, that applause and the sounds of the audience are important, and here's why.
Which would then orient listeners to her particular stance on the topic at hand.
Because most research with recordings of poetry readings are focused on the poets, for obvious reasons. So I wanted to start off sort of stating that.
And while Ali didn't particularly focus on vocal inflections or registers,
I don't think I was successful in thinking about that. I wasn't thinking like, oh, okay, well, my voice should signal these shifts in the narrative arc.
She had a strong sense of how the structure of her podcast was mobilized by the complexities of an idea.
The middle section is more about the work that I've been doing to figure out how to talk about applause in a way that isn't just, oh, it lasts this many seconds and it's loud or it's quiet, but to come up with terms that are more specific to the qualitative essence of different moments of applause.
But Ali also reflected on how her structure was mobilized through the possibilities of an idea.
And then the ending is sort of where I still am, in a way, which is that there's a lot more that can be done to develop that further. And there's a lot of exciting possibilities for tracing performances across even just different days or different years or decades and different locations, and charting sort of the responses from different audiences in different contexts to the same poet and the same work.
So if my approach was to structure emotively and Ali's was to structure more theoretically, Emma's further diversified our set of approaches. Emma ended up taking, at least initially, a structured approach to structure.
I resorted to what I know how to do, which is how to write a paper. So I thought about it. I thought to myself, okay, what's going to be my introduction? What's the body? And then what's the conclusion?
But also found in the process that essay and podcast structure have some fundamental differences.
Except that it was almost more scary, because it was just like, how do I, first of all, put sounds onto this platform and then also make them make sense?
And that these differences call for different approaches.
So I had various clips that I liked. I wrote a script. Then in the end, I had all these sound bites or clips that I just needed to assemble into a collage. Like, the whole thing to me felt like a collage.
And that these approaches rely on feeling in different ways.
But when you do that, there's not necessarily like a linear structure that you have right away. So it's also just trusting that the process will reveal itself. I didn't know how to conclude this in a way that would be engaging and not too formal and not too academic. And that's when I decided to include the poem late August, which just felt like it needed to be there somewhere. And to end it with that, I think, was to go back to, like, just to come back to the reading.
I love that move at the end of your podcast. And it relates to what we've been talking about this whole time, because it's a return to verbal rendering of a mood. So it's a way to return to the poem on the page, or language, the actual words themselves, communicating what you've been communicating through through the rhetoric of podcasting with using, you know, sound and mixing and all those other things up to that point. So it's sort of like a return to text, to print, you know, and to the power of poetry and words themselves to do what you've been doing up to that point with sound.
So that about sums up the conversations we had based on the amazing podcasts that Ali, Emma, and Sadie made. As you heard, our focus was on the mood that's created through ambient sounds, the overall rhetoric of the podcast, and how voice carries affective expression of concepts. By way of closing, we tried a little experiment. Basically, the idea was to choose some classic critical terms, like things from M.H. Abrams' Glossary of Literary Terms, and to read them with feeling, with the feeling that we associate with the critical term in question. So here it goes, our kind of beat poetry performance of the Glossary of Critical and Literary Terms, where ideas have feelings.
Literature.
You know, like, hey, interpolation.
Interpolation. There has to be a finger in there, you know, like, interpolation.
Yoo-hoo, interpolation.
Interpolation.
That's terrifying.
Hey. How do you? Interpolation. Interpolation.
Hi, my name is I'm
Id.
Hermeneutic.
Hermeneutics.
Spoken Web is a monthly podcast produced by the Spoken Web team as part of distributing the audio collected from and created using Canadian literary archival recordings found at universities across Canada. Our producers this month are Ali Barilero, Sadie Barker, Emma Tolaro, and Jason Camlott. A special thanks to everyone who contributed to the Spoken Web podcast over the last season. You know who you are. And hey, if you are part of the Spoken Web network and want to get involved, let us know. Season 2 is just around the corner, so stay tuned this fall for brand new episodes from all your favorite scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. We'll also be back with brand new Audio of the Month minisodes with Catherine McLeod from Deep in the Archives. To find out more about Spoken Web, visit spokenweb.ca and subscribe to the Spoken Web podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may listen. If you love us, let us know. Rate us and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or say hi on our social media at Spoken Web Canada. We'll see you back here in the fall for another episode of the Spoken Web podcast, stories about how literature sounds.